What I had wanted to do with you all this afternoon was to perhaps bring some of the experience that I've had as a manager of peace building and conflict prevention programs from the Canadian perspective mainly, and share those with you. And I should say, by the way, that's compatible with one of the jobs that I was asked to do by my government a number of years ago that led me, in fact, to this relationship that I have with Japan and now Nagoya University. And that was at some moment in the late 90s, Canada, CETA, my agency, and JICA, your agency here in Japan, under agreement with your prime minister and our prime minister in Canada, agreed to do joint work mainly through NGOs and mainly in the area of peace-building conflict prevention. So the relationship between the Canadians and the Japanese in this area is not an entirely new one. And we have seen some real practice between the NGOs of the two countries in third countries, in Cambodia and Guatemala and Ethiopia in particular. But I'm not going to use examples from there today. I'm really going to talk about perhaps a different one that yields a number of cases for a number of issues for us. But prior to doing that, I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about my perspective on some of the big ticket items, the big picture, if you will, in development cooperation and peace building conflict prevention in the global paradigm. Certainly one of the most important issues, I think, that needs to be looked at is the whole question of the degradation of the nation state. I think that that's a very, very critical post-war issue. And I refer, by the way, to the beginnings of that issue in important ways in post-Second World War, but certainly accelerated by the end of the Cold War. And when I talk about the degradation of the nation state, I begin to really talk about the degradation of the central power of the nation state and the centralizing power of the nation state. As we began to survey a lot of the areas in Africa, in particular in the Middle East and parts of Asia that were in the new form of conflict, which tends to be intra-state rather than interstate, one of the things that we began to notice was that the areas that were most vulnerable, if you will, to entering into armed conflict indeed were areas, in fact, that the central state power had never, in fact, really extended its authority to the full range of. That the tendency on the part of the states in the post-Cold War period to redefine themselves and redefine, often, by the way, under the pressure of international capital, to become purveyors of resources in the outreaches of their own national territory led many of them indeed into conflicts that we hadn't seen before, some of which began to take on the characteristics of tribal conflicts, began to take on the characteristics of linguistic conflicts. But above all, they were fights about rights, the rights to resources, the rights to justice, the rights to many different kinds of things, but they certainly were rights that were beginning to appear to come forward from the outreaches of states that hadn't really been there before. And that was most evident in the case of the colonial states that of Africa, in which governments were established around elites in the post-colonial period, who in fact didn't really have control over their own nation. And as they began to expand outward, those conflicts began to come home to, the chickens came home to roost. So that's one area in which we're beginning to see some important degradation. Of course, that is being further complicated by the growth and the power of the multinational corporations who have began to really challenge centralized state power and began to take away much of the authority of the state. What states can do today to control conflicts within their own border is not a great deal. They don't have the full power. They don't have the full authority. And that's weakening. And in some sense, that may or may not be a bad thing, because we're beginning to see, indeed, the reorganization of jurisdictions in which regional powers are becoming more important, indeed local powers are becoming more important. So that degradation of the classic state is a very, very important factor in the whole framework of conflict and conflict resolution. For us, another kind of thing I think that we're seeing that's important is an increase in scale of the dynamics of conflict. And here I'm not suggesting anything about more conflicts, fewer conflicts. What I'm suggesting is more people are involved with conflict in specialized ways. There's more engagement, perhaps, than we've seen for a very long time. And I can't quantify that in relationship to a great deal of past, because historically we haven't seen that before. We're seeing new specialization, if you will, in victimization and new specialization in perpetration. There are more kinds of people committing more kinds of conflict on each other than we've seen before, in short. And dealing with that degree of specialization, that increase in scale, more and more specialized, is something that we're going to have to think about how we begin to approach. We never used to think of seniors being in conflict and senior victims being a specialized group. Now we have to begin to talk about that, and senior women victims. So there are more specializations. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. We also need to perhaps understand a little bit that conflicts have began to become more permeable. There's more permeability involved, by which I mean, as conflicts emerge, more institutional action between the state and civil society, for example, between the victims and the victimizers, between state and state. So we're beginning to see a greater transmission, circulation, if you will, of information, of goods related to the conflict, of services related to the conflict. You heard in the very beginning, the opening statement, that for some people conflict is profitable. That was one of the very first statements made, and I smiled, and I think you smiled as well, because indeed it's true, and some of you in this very room may end up making your living off conflicts. Conflicts make some people very rich and very comfortable. But that's the permeability factor that I'm referring to, the permeation of goods and services and ideas about conflict and, in some measure, of course, control of conflict, which was one of the discussions that took place before. And that was a central paradigm, a logic, if you will, that Professor Tosa was talking about and Professor Cushing. From my framework, my point of view in looking at the same issue, it's really a case of the permeability of our own minds, a permeability of the logic frame approach to conflict that we, especially in the industrialized nations, have become very fond of. Results-based management. We're going to prevent and resolve our conflicts through a results-based approach, through a logic framework. Well, of course, in doing that, we're setting up a map of reality and then imposing it on reality. We've set up our model and we're saying, this is our model and reality sure had better match that, or else we're going to force reality into matching it because we have to be accountable for solving and preventing the conflict. There's a real need to understand that the map is not the reality. The map is not the territory. So we need to be sensitive with respect to the generation of paradigms and models and understand that they are paradigms and they are models. And above all, they're paradigms and models of our own mind and our own interest. Another important factor, apart from the permeability, is to understand how that permeability plays out institutionally in the era in which we are. One of, for me, the most striking things since September 11th, the famous September 11th, has been watching the galvanization of interest around the war on terrorism within the very aid community that I work so very hard to manage for and to support. A decade ago, not one of the major donors, of the major 22 OECD DAC donors, had Iraq or Afghanistan on its top 10 list of recipients. Guess what? Today, only four or five don't. Do not. The bulk of the donors now have shifted their programs into a securitized focus around Afghanistan and Iraq. Indeed, my government, much to my surprise, and my agency, much to my surprise, have recently reorganized. For the long history of the work that we did at CEDA and most of the other bilateral agencies, for those of you who are aid specialists, you know, of course, that you would have a branch that deals with Asia, a branch that deals with Latin America, a branch that deals with Africa. I.e., branches are normally built continentally, but for the first time in anyone's recorded history in Canada, Afghanistan, one country, has become a branch, equivalent to all of Africa, all of Asia, all of Latin America, and, by the way, Central Europe, too. Quite remarkable that that would happen. So that kind of permeability is one of the kinds that we need to think about. And by the way, I wish I could say it was just Canada, but I can't. And I wish I could say that it was just about structural reorganization of aid agencies, but I can't. I have to also say it's about relationships. Relationships to the organizations that often, in fact, carry out the aid, implement the programs. The NGOs, the civil society organizations of various types, increasingly have become, to use the term of the day, aligned, if you will. They have to align themselves with the objectives of the country, its foreign policy, and the aid policy that flows from that. And if they're not prepared to do that, they very quickly find themselves on the outside looking in. So not everyone is eligible to be a peace builder or a conflict preventer. So let's bear that in mind as we go forward. Okay, that we now have a new framework of eligibility, and eligibility is very much associated with increased securitization, increased militarization of aid. But I wish it stopped there, because it doesn't. It goes further. Because securitization and militarization are not only the way resources flow into institutions and which institutions, it's how they flow into institutions and how they're managed within institutions. Non-governmental organizations about which we were concerned a decade ago, in which the main thought was, are they democratic? Do they have memberships? Do they have constituents, or are they just NGO oligarchs? Today have begun to move toward command and control management, because that's what the system does. It creates a command and control management. You don't question from the bottom. You can't do that in a military, and you can't do that in structures that are associated with militaries. Again, to go back to the logic frame, it's all about accountability. It's not about input. We now, I think, are faced with some fairly serious problems in the international community, because the issues are not just about permeability and security in the nation state. I think it's about the international system. Our problem, I think, has been building since the beginning of the Bretton Woods institutions as a whole, and this is an argument every one of you has heard before, that the Bretton Woods institutions indeed may be outdated. Well, we've said it, and we've said it, and we've said it, and we've said it. But now, we may have reached a point at which we have no choice but to begin to really seriously redo the international architecture. I think that the problems that have been described by my two colleagues are of such a very profound nature, to which I would add, by the way, the new crisis in monetarism. And for those of you who aren't aware, you'd better understand that we're in big trouble on the monetary front. Just check your newspaper every day. Please understand that your stock exchange here in Tokyo has lost, on average, 35% of its share stock value in a very short period of time. So this monetary crisis that we're facing is also feeding into some of these issues that we're talking about, and it's going to accelerate them. That's the effect. It's going to accelerate the instability and accelerate the concern of every single one of the problems that's been described perhaps in Professor Cushing's, you know, well-worked-out paradigm. So it's time that that was done. And we can talk later about maybe how we do that. But certainly we're facing a crisis of inclusiveness right across the board. And a large part of the paradigm that we have to begin to rebuild will have to really become one in which inclusiveness becomes the watchword. It will not be one that is able to rely upon the traditional elites of nation states. For those of you who, if you can't imagine it, I suggest you start beginning to imagine the Japanese without a Japan, as you know it. The Japanese as a multiracial, multicultural, multilinguistic society, as you know it. Because that's the kind of world that you're going to be merging into if you're going to be effective as peace builders and conflict preventers. It's got to change. And by the way, I would dare say that that's the challenge facing not only Japan, you're not unique in that sense, it's facing many nations. We've all got our little things that we have to work through. I'd like to, for a moment, talk a little bit about some of the experience that we've had in trying to do peace building and conflict prevention programs. And in particular, maybe even before doing that, I'd like to maybe just remind you that there are some very hot spots that tell us an awful lot about international conflict, in which all of the items kind of come together. There are some better cases than other cases. Certainly, in my view, the best case of the day, and I'll be very interested in hearing what my colleagues think about this later, has got to be Darfur and Sudan, in which for the first time we're seeing a global conflict that's partly about ethnicity and the other. It's partly about religion. It's partly about resources. Of course, with desertification and all of these issues occurring. All of the major issues in the paradigm begin to come to a head and crystallize in one remarkable example. And I would dare say that the most pure example is probably Sudan Darfur. But before talking about that, I'd like to maybe back up and talk about the experience that we had in Lebanon, because it also yielded for us a lot of understanding. Lebanon was a good case in point after 17 years of civil war, of trying to do some post-conflict management. And these terms post and pre and prevent, i.e. where we put our time markers in this world of conflict professionalism, we need to be a bit careful. Because conflicts that we're dealing with, the actual armed conflicts, are usually outcomes of conflicts that have been long, long, long in the making. We have to understand that our nation states are like archaeological digs in which just under the surface are the profiles of times past. There are things covered in the sediments of time. And what through the mist of time we're has emerged is a nation state that we're dealing with in the here and now. And chances are the structural issues have always been there. We just haven't seen them. Or they were put into a box by some colonial power. But the stuff was there. Let's understand that. In the case of Lebanon, after 17 years of civil war, we encountered a situation. The situation was the following, and it's true of many places that are in extreme armed conflict. The government really didn't have any power. In fact, there was no government. Who was in charge was civil society. In the absence of government, civil society began to take responsibility through NGOs for education, for public health, for all of the key sectors. And it wasn't just very simple that one group of civil society people did that. Please bear in mind that this was a conflict. So each of the parties to conflict, ethnically, religiously, had its own group working on education, its own group working on public health. So you had a diffraction of anything that would have been a national system in which each confessional group set up its own system. Well, that was problem as it was because in the first instance, there was no accountability for the funds that they had to set those up. One of the first situations we encountered in looking at the medical clinics of one of the NGOs networks was, who owns them? And people looked and they said, you know, what kind of question is that? They're NGOs. How can you ask us that question? I said, well, I'm asking the question, who owns it? Well, I guess I do, said the executive director. Well, of course he did, because the buildings were all purchased for nothing practically, or simply taken over, in the absence of the citizens who had run away from the war. It's pretty easy to pick up properties when people are running from bullets. Well, that was corruption number one, right? And it wasn't the government, right? By now we were talking about the unaccountability, let alone corruption, of the civil society sector. And that was critical because not only were they unaccountable, not only had they established themselves as corrupt, they also were, in each case, related to militias, those who had actually done the fighting. Because, of course, they had to pay off the militias to have existed in the first place. And we saw some of that in Eastern Europe as well. NGOs that are able to survive through battlegrounds are connected to somebody. You'd better be, or else you're not going to be there. So there was that connectivity that we had to worry about. There was also the relationship between them. Now remember that I'm speaking of a society that's divided confessionally, as we say. Shiites, Sunnis, Druze, Christians of different types, in fact 17 groups in all. The problematic of bringing them all together at the end of the war to do a reconciliation, that was difficult enough in itself. But then we were also faced with the other problem of how do you now get them to give up what they have? You know, when people are making money off medical clinics, it's hard for them to go back and say to a new government of national reconciliation, here's your medical system back. In fact, the leader of it said to me, are you crazy? Do you realize how much money we're going to give up to those guys? We need this for the people. So the whole question of the possession of the state sectors becomes very important, and we had to work that through. Lebanon was also complicated further by the fact that you have, and you saw the consequence this summer, of a Palestinian expatriate refugee group of substantive numbers and who have impacted the politics of Lebanon very profoundly. In addition to which, the country was still under occupation by two groups. The Israelis to the south, still occupying part of the Palestine, and the Syrians were still there. So the people didn't have full control of their own country. This was real movement now that we were seeing in trans-border interests. What we decided to do was we decided that we had better get creative here. We had better start to think about building, and this is certainly the final word on this to you, to become creative. To be peace builders and conflict preventers, you need to be creative. What we did was we created a new institution called the Lebanese NGO Parliamentary Center, the Dialogue Center, and brought all of the players together after doing negotiations with each sector. We had to do very, very patient negotiations between the NGO networks representing the Shiites and the Sunnis, the Druze. We had to do it in sections slowly. We had to cut deals. We had to begin to get people to understand that peace building and conflict prevention, as we move towards solutions, involves the mobility of trade, that you're trading factors, you're trading values. Did we succeed? I would say that we came very close to succeeding. I would say we improved the situation. I'm now moving quickly for lack of time. But I think that we began to achieve some result because the civil society group indeed did begin the process of giving up some of the space back to the governance. And the government began to understand that they had to work with civil society. We underestimated, I think, the extent to which we ourselves were actors in that situation and had to begin to reflect back into the situation what our model had put in and began to bracket that. So there's a lot of scope and room for discussion in that area. But anyway, I'm going to leave it there because I think that that example, plus what I've said about permeability and the increase in scale and the nation state, I think is probably enough for now. Thank you very much. Am I okay for time?